Thanks for checking out this podcast from Christ Church of Ornogo. Our hope is that it helps you discover completeness in Jesus. Now for this week's teaching.
We sang the words this morning, I am a child of God. And if you think about the logical implications of that, if I'm a child of God, number one, I don't deserve to be called that. But number two, like if I'm a child of God, like he's a child of God, and she is, and he is, and she is. And if I start to see people that way, it'll actually transform how I look and love people as well. We've been in a sermon series over the last few weeks about the character of David, King David. And we've actually been looking at his story through the lens of the title of the series called A Man After God's Own Heart. And we've reminded ourselves over and over again that it's not so much that David is perfect, but that David keeps returning to the one and returning his heart to the one who is perfect. But so far in David's story, as we look at his story, one of the things we discover is that like we've kind of had the highlight reel so far. I mean, David seemed so far like a hero. I mean, he's the unexpected shepherd boy who is able to slay lions and bears with his bare hands. That's pretty incredible. I'm actually driving after third service today to Colorado. I'll do a little bit of hiking, going to do some speaking in Colorado. I mean, if I come across a mountain lion, I'm hoping that that's a little bit of like my highlight story at some point. It's pretty incredible that David does this. And he's this shepherd boy who then grows up and he writes songs. Like not only is he able to slay lions and bears, but he writes poetry. And these are songs that people sing and they collect, poems that people memorize. And we move on in his story, and he's a slayer of giants and a conqueror of armies, and he becomes the unexpected king. And you're like, wow, like this is an incredible story. We should like, I don't know, write this down. And the Holy Spirit's like, yep, did that, thanks. And there's a point of David's story where it looks like this documentary, this chronicling of David's heroic epic events. And then we open up to chapter 11. Like even the immediate context in chapter 10 is like, David is defeating the Ammonites. Yay, look at the highlight reel. I'm kind of thankful that David's story is not just the highlight reel. You know, at some level, if someone were to call you today, this is somewhat hypothetical and somewhat silly, but if someone were to call you today, let's say you get home from church this afternoon, someone were to call you up and they're to say, hey, my name's Sam, I'm a producer, and we're trying to tell stories of just random people in the Midwest and trying to make a documentary of their lives, and we'd like to tell your story. In fact, we'd like to fly out to the Joplin Airport. We'd like to bring kind of an entourage of storytellers to come and hear your story, interview your family members, talk to your friends, talk to your coworkers. We'd love to make this into a full-length documentary. First of all, you'd probably hang up thinking it's a prank, right? At some level. But at some level, you hang up your phone and you're like, whoa. And your head starts to spin. Like, who's going to play me? I was afraid to ask my kids that question, by the way. Like, who would play me in a movie about me? And what stories would they tell? And you're holding your phone and you're still kind of frozen in that moment. And you're thinking through your story. I don't know where you go. I mean, maybe in your story, you go to like social media and some of the highlights that you have posted along the way, you know, epic vacations and epic adventures and highlight relational moments. Or maybe you go to the family scrapbooks on the lower shelf of the bookshelf in your kitchen and you pull those off the bookshelf and you flip through those and you realize, oh yeah, we only did these when we had like one or two kids and then we stopped. Huh, interesting. And then you go up to the attic. I have one of these. You go up to the attic and you pull this box out. It's a box of like all of the old medals and, you know, memorabilia. I still have my teddy bear from the day I was born. My mom's best friend gave it to her and gave it to me. It's like a bad Toy Story moment. He's like shoved in a box up in my attic. And you pull those out and you're like, maybe these would be the things that I'd tell my story. But my hunch is this, at some point, there would be parts of your story that you'd rather leave in a box up in the attic. Darker parts of your story that you'd rather leave cut on the cutting room floor if your story were to be told. You see, I don't know how David feels that this story is told. I don't know.
But what we have as we come to 2 Samuel chapter 11 is not just this highlight reel of David's life, but it's this story of David's heart and the hurt that David's heart causes. And we start to recognize that David's not the hero in this story at all. And it's not a heroic epic at all. In fact, if anything, what David's story does seem to do is point not to David as the hero, but to the one who is actually the hero. Like, David's story reminds us that in our stories, we at times will have hearts that need replaced and recreated, that we at times will actually inflict pain on others because of our heart. But the point of that story is actually to bring about the hero of our stories, which is the one who brings healing into our stories. So we want to look at 2 Samuel chapters 11 and 12. We'll also flip into the book of Psalms. And we want to talk about three parts of David's story. We want to talk about David's heart. We want to talk about the heart in David's story. We want to talk about the hurt in David's story. And we want to talk about the healing in David's story as well. So we'll unpack the next few chapters in that way to dive into looking at David's heart, almost like, let's say, you know, medical examiner. You know, let's have a post-op opportunity to look at David. What's going on in his heart? Let's do that as we dive into 2 Samuel chapter 11, verses 1 through 5. In the spring, at the time when kings go off to war. Now, little side note, kind of a nerd side note. The month of March, did you know it's named after the god Mars? As in like the god of war? Because March is the time you march off to go to war. So this is March, a time when kings go off to war. Not necessarily the month of March, but that time of year. But I need to notice what David does. David's not marching in March. Instead, David's sending. Can I ask you to do something for me as we go on this journey together? This word sent really becomes an important word in David's story at understanding David's heart. So if I could get you to kind of get out your mental highlighter, and as you see the words, or if you see the words, can I get you to kind of mentally or maybe physically even highlight that word as we walk through this story? Because there's something going on with the word sent in the story that helps us understand David's heart in the story. So in the spring, when kings go off to war, David sent his commander, Joab, out with the king's men and the whole Israelite army. But David stayed. David remained in Jerusalem. And the first one sounds like another highlight reel. His army's defeating the Ammonites, they're besieging Rabbah, and David's just hanging out in Jerusalem. Verse 2, one evening, David got up from his bed and he walked around the roof of the palace. Now notice as David is looking out, he's looking down. As David looked from the roof of his palace, he saw a woman bathing. The woman was very beautiful, and David sent someone to find out about her. The man said, "She is Bathsheba, the daughter of Eliam, the wife of Uriah the Hittite." Notice, she has an identity. She's someone's daughter. She's someone's wife. David then sent messengers to go get her. She came to him. He slept with her. Then there's an aside. She was, when he saw her, purifying herself from her monthly uncleanliness. It's kind of a little Jerry Springer aside, because what happens is the woman conceives, verse 5. And then notice the irony. She sends word back to David saying, "I am pregnant." Huh? How did we get here? David's story seemed like this highlight reel up to now. Where's that shepherd boy who's slaying lions? Guy who's slaying giants? Where's the guy who's writing songs about his desire for God and pursuing God like a deer longs for streams of water? We look into David's heart, and I think we ask the question, like, how did David get here? And we recognize there's something going on here. So we start to investigate. We start to ask questions. And we might ask a question like this. Well, obviously, David was on his roof and he was bored. And it was the time of year when kings should be off to war. And there David was. He stayed in Jerusalem. Maybe it was just dereliction of duty and David was bored. Maybe. I mean, maybe you know this, that at some level, some temptations come when we're not fighting the battles we ought to be fighting in the first place. We're not fighting the battle for our family. We're not fighting the battle that's a spiritual battle that's always going around us. We find ourselves bored and distracted. And temptation comes. Maybe. And yet I also want to dive a little bit deeper to go, maybe something a little deeper is going on in David's heart. Now, unfortunately, there are others who would come and say, well, maybe it's Bathsheba's fault. I want to be pretty clear in this moment. Nowhere in the story does God or those who speak on his behalf point the finger at Bathsheba in this story. Like David's clearly in the spotlight for the one who has the heart that brings hurt in the story. What's going on in David's heart? I think at some level we would recognize something that is something we'd all recognize, is at some level David in that moment lusted after Bathsheba, and we would talk about the lust of the flesh, and we talk about his lust for Bathsheba. And maybe we need to ask, like, what is the nature of lust really? As he looks down from his palace roof, down on someone, culturally, by the way, that'd be a fairly normal place to bathe. Maybe one of the things we'd recognize is at some level, at its base in our heart, lust is taking someone who is a daughter and who is a, perhaps, wife, if anything, a child of God. Remember, the lyrics change how we see other people. And David, in that moment, decreates Bathsheba, like devalues her. In fact, you'll notice he doesn't even use her name. The messenger uses her name and talks about her relational connection. But David does not. He disconnects that. Disconnects her value, disconnects her identity. And at some level, lust is not just the stripping away of clothing, but also the stripping away of identity. And I want us to see this in David's heart. And I want us to see this in David's story. Because we can dive deeper and ask some questions about how did he get here. And here's one of the things that I need you to know. I don't know that dynamic of devaluing people and seeing them as created for his purposes and his pleasures rather than God's was the only time David was seeing people this way. And sometimes it manifested itself in lust, as in the case of Bathsheba. But other times, this heart of David, if I get down to the heart of David in the story, what's going on in the heart of David? Here's what I discover. David, perhaps partly because he is on a throne and feels entitled, his heart has started to see people as created for his purposes and his pleasures rather than God's. And the kind of case study that manifests itself the clearest is the way he looks at Bathsheba in lust. That brings me back to that word sent. Because notice how David treats those around him. Chapter 11, verse 1, David sent Joab. Chapter 11, verse 3, David sent someone to find out about Sheba. In chapter 11, verse 5, somewhat ironically, she sent word back to David, "I'm pregnant." But then it goes on. Notice verse 6. David then, hearing that Bathsheba was pregnant, sent this word to Joab, his commander. "Send me Uriah the Hittite." So now he's sending commanders and sending military soldiers back. Uriah the Hittite, again, is Bathsheba's husband. "Send me Uriah the Hittite." And Joab sent Uriah to David. When Uriah came to him, David asked him how Joab was, how the soldiers were, kind of just small talk, you know, how are things going on the front lines? And David said to Uriah, "Hey, go down to your house and wash your feet." It's kind of a weird euphemism, but it's a euphemism. So Uriah left the palace, and notice what David did. A gift from the king was sent after Uriah. David's trying to like set the mood. It's kind of awkward, but he's trying to set the mood. And what you discover in the next several verses is Uriah goes down, but because he's loyal to the king and loyal to God, he actually never goes home and stays home. The next day, David's frustrated because his plan to cover up his own sin isn't working. So he brings Uriah back. "My gift didn't work. Probably food and wine." So what does he do? He throws a feast. Uriah's there. He gets him drunk. He sends him home. Uriah doesn't go home again. David's frustrated. So he starts writing a letter. Notice what we have starting in verse 13. In the evening, this is halfway through verse 13. "In the evening, Uriah went out to sleep on his mat with his master's servants." He didn't go home. But in the morning, verse 14, David wrote a letter to Joab the commander who's still off at war. And he sent this letter. There's that word send again. He sent this letter with Uriah. In it, David wrote, "Put Uriah out on the front lines where the fighting is the fiercest." Now, I don't know how David was able to take this note, this letter, seal it, give it to the very guy as the messenger to carry his own death warrant. Then, Joab, what I want you to do is I want you to pull everyone else back so that when Uriah's there, he's going to be struck down and he's going to die. So while Joab had the city under siege, he put Uriah in a place where he knew the strongest defenders were of the city. Verse 17, when the men of the city came out and fought against Joab, some of the men of David's army fell. And moreover, Uriah the Hittite died. And so Joab, like Bathsheba, sent David a full account of the battle. This is the second after-action report sent back to David of his own failures in battle. Bathsheba sends, Joab sends. And David's lost. But so have so many others. You know, when we come to the story, sometimes we're looking at David and we're like, I don't like what I see here. He's not a hero at all, is he? I go, no, that's not how the Bible pictures him. In fact, it pictures his heart as something and someone who needs to be healed, not as the hero, and as someone who brings hurt. Can I tell you that over the last several weeks, as I've wrestled with this, preparing for this weekend, one of the questions that keeps coming into mind is this question. Am I ever tempted to see people as created for my purposes and my desires and my pleasures rather than God's? Am I ever tempted to devalue someone from being a child of God and just see them as being one of my subjects, as I sit on my throne? I don't know how that hits you and how that applies to you. But my hunch is that sometimes when we look at David and we look at his story through the window, sometimes we actually see ourselves in the mirror and we're repulsed at David's story. But if we're honest, sometimes we're repulsed at our own story and our own heart. And we go, oh, some of that's in me too. See, sometimes we can see a spouse or see our children, coworkers, our friends, people in church with us, staff in church. And we could think that God put them on this planet to serve our needs. Now, we wouldn't come out right and say that, but we sure would send them to do things. We traffic people as commodities. We digitalize their images and strip them of their names, sending them for profit and pleasure and consuming them for profit and pleasure. And then we shrug at the casualties of hurt in the culture around us. I mean, we do this. And sometimes we look down from our palace roofs on others and we see them as created for our purposes and pleasure. And so it's no surprise that the hurt we see in David's story is sometimes the hurt we experience in our own stories. Because as Joab sends word back, he sends an after-action report, a battle report back to David. And what we start to unpack is some of the hurt that's now coming from David's actions as he's tried to cover up his own actions. It wasn't just his heart with Bathsheba. It's actually been his heart with his soldiers, with his commander, with Uriah. And over again, we see casualties piling up. The after-action report becomes this casualty report. Messenger comes back to David. Sir, I'm bringing back a report from the front lines from Joab. All right, tell me what's in the report. Well, sir, we attacked the city just as you commanded. And sir, there's some bad news. Okay, tell me the news. Sir, some of the men were trapped up toward the front where the fighting was the fiercest. And some of those men, sir, lost their lives. Moreover, sir, Uriah, you know Uriah, right? Yeah, I know Uriah. Uriah died too, sir. But then in chapter 11, verse 25, notice what David says back to the messenger. Hey, send this back or say this back to Joab. Hey, Joab, don't let this news upset you. The sword devours one just as well as the other. And David's like, this is war. But my guess is David didn't have to be the one that day that went and knocked on someone's door and have a wife answer and have a report told and see the knees crumple and see the eyes wet with tears and hear the cries as another family member comes to the door and then wonders how they're going to tell the kids that their dad is not coming home. Bathsheba is again hurt as she hears word back about her husband. Like, do you see David's heart and see the hurt that is now piling up? It looks like people are walking out of war and they're suffering from shell shock. They're just walking around wounded. And it's all because of this heart of David that he tried to cover up with the blood of others. And over the next 8 chapters, you're going to discover that David's family and the generations that come after him are going to suffer some of the consequences from this moment. And boy, this morning, like, it's one of those things where just the story is pretty heavy. Because I also recognize this is not just David's story. Like, some of you are living like those who are walking out of what, I mean, I see the images again of like maybe September 11th. People are walking out of devastation and they have the dust on their face and the eyes that are just kind of glazed over. Some of you are living in maybe a family sin or a situation where, boy, whether it's your hurt or someone else's hurt, your heart or someone else's heart, like, it's left devastation. Internally, David said he's also experiencing some pain. And maybe you're like, I don't really care about David in this moment. But maybe you would want to know this about David because it is his heart and it is he who hurt others. But he himself is also hurting. He's going to write about it. He's going to say in multiple songs, multiple journal entries, multiple poems, he's going to say things like this: my bones ached. It felt like my body was being crushed. It felt like the hand of God was pressing down on me. So not only do you have this after action report, this battle report that comes back from Joab, and the list of casualties and the list of hurt, you also have David who inside his own heart, inside his own core of his being, is also hurting. And the reason why this story is told is not to make David the hero. It's not so we can put him on a flannel graph or put him in a cartoon. It's not so we can make a movie about him and go, hey, look at David the king. It's actually to say, hey, look at David, the one whose heart hurt and needed healing just like yours. Because when you see David in his story for what it really is, you recognize that our hurting stories don't highlight our story at all. But they highlight Jesus' healing story. See, I don't like what I find in David's story, but can I be honest? I don't always like what I find in my story. And if God can bring healing into David's story, then perhaps his story is designed to bring me to the one who can bring healing in my story as well. You see, it seems like at this point, like David had hid from his sin. I mean, the report came back from war, Uriah's dead, Bathsheba becomes his wife. It looks like everything's just going to, like, I don't know, turn out fine. But then chapter 11, verse 27 comes up, and it says this: but the thing David had done displeased the Lord. It's not that God was blind. And the very thing that pleased David, or the things that pleased David as he sent people to do what he wanted them to do, was the very thing that displeased God, as God actually sits down on his throne and looks down to us. But I need you to understand that really this is the beginning of healing for David. That God in this moment, seeing David where he's at, doesn't want David to stay where he's at. And so notice what happens in chapter 12, verse 1. It's kind of an unfortunate chapter break. There in chapter 12, verse 1, the word the Lord, the phrase the Lord, notice what he does. He sends. The Lord sent Nathan to David. David is seen by God. His heart and the hurt is seen by God exactly where he's at. But God loves him so much that he sends someone, that he sends Nathan to him. And Nathan comes. And Nathan, as he comes to him, tells David this parable. He says, David, there's a guy who, he was a shepherd and he stole someone else's sheep and he killed him for a stranger. And it's like this really tragic parable for like a shepherd boy to hear. And you can kind of see David's heart. It's like, oh, and he then gets mad. And in chapter 12, verse 6, here's what he says: he must pay. And you're like, really? Like, you're on the throne saying that guy must pay. And then Nathan says, chapter 12, verse 7, you are the man. Now, you can read this, I guess, a couple different ways. You could read it like, you're the man, David. My hunch is he didn't say it that way. My hunch is he said it like, this is you. And And maybe that's how this sermon hits you this morning. I don't know. Maybe you thought it was just going to be like David and Bathsheba, and you're like, I don't really struggle with that. But then you think about like the way that you look down from your throne that you sit on, and how you interact with your kids, and how you interact with your coworkers, and how you interact with your neighbors, and how you interact with others. And all of a sudden you hear the Spirit saying, this is you. Chip mentioned earlier, sometimes our kids make messes that they can't clean up on their own. My youngest daughter one time was playing Frozen, and my wife tells this story because she's the one who cleaned it up, but got into the flour in our kitchen and used it as snow, right, to get all over the kitchen. It's not the only time. She also got into our fireplace and got out some of the ashes they had cooled off, praise the Lord, and got out some of the ashes, was spreading those around, singing Let It Go or whatever it was. And you know this, she was not at that age. Now, she's older now, but she was not at that age going to clean this up on her own. My wife came along and helped her. David has tried to clean this mess up on his own. He can't recreate his heart, and he can't heal the hurt. And so I need you to hear this, that Nathan is actually sent to David as a part of the healing process so that David could, first of all, see his sin, but then take his heart and his sin and take it to the one who could bring healing. The next few verses, Nathan walks through this journey with David, and he says this, David, do you remember how good God was to you? Do you remember what God did for you? David, do you remember the grace of God? He took you as a shepherd boy, and you were kind of the youngest brother, and he put you on the throne, and he called you to lead and shepherd his people. David, do you remember how good God has been to you? How you slayed the giant, but it wasn't you, it was his power, and you knew that. David, do you remember? Then David, why did you respond in this way? And at that point, I think David sees himself for the first time clearly in the mirror, that you're the man moment. And I think he, rather than saying, you're the man, which is I think maybe what he was saying, is I think he actually starts to recognize, oh, you're that guy. And how he responds in chapter 12, verse 13, is the reason why we are able to say about David, he is a man after God's own heart. Because David takes his heart and his hurt, and he takes it to the God who can heal. David says to Nathan, I have sinned against the Lord. And scholars tell me it's actually kind of interesting that in many of the ancient manuscripts, there's actually a space, a gap that's left after this particular line so that we can infer what David writes in his journal or in his songbook from Psalm 51. What we discover as we come to Psalm 51 is this song likely was written from the context of this story. And I need you to hear it because I think it fleshes out that little phrase, I have sinned against the Lord. But it's this cry for David with a heart that is hurting and a heart that has hurt others for God to come in and do something different in him and to bring healing. Listen to this song. Have mercy on me, O God. According to your unfailing love, according to your great compassion, blot out my transgressions. Wash away all my iniquity and cleanse me from my sin. For I know my transgressions, they play like movie reels in my mind. My sin is always before me. Against you and you only have I sinned. I've done what was evil in your sight. You're right in your verdict. You're right and justified when you judge. Surely I was sinful at birth, sinful from the moment my mother conceived me, yet you desired faithfulness even in the womb. You taught me wisdom in that secret place. God, cleanse me with hyssop, and I'll be clean. Wash me, and I'll be whiter than snow. Let me hear joy and gladness. Let the bones that you have crushed rejoice. Hide your face, not from me, but from my sins, and blot out my iniquity. See what David does? He can't cover up his sin anymore, not even by the blood of others. And yet, he wants God to recreate, and he uses Genesis language in that same song, chapter 51, verse 10, create in me a clean heart, O God, and renew a right spirit within me. Cast me not away from your presence. Take not your Holy Spirit from me, but restore to me the joy of my salvation. See, what's interesting is that when David calls and asks God to recreate a new heart in him, only God is capable of doing that. See, we're not asking you to do better or be better, behave more. We're asking you to be recreated by the one who can bring healing into hurting stories and hurting hearts. Here's what's intriguing to me about David's story. The impact of David's pain would last generations. And as we flip through the Bible, we actually flip over to Matthew chapter 1. And in Matthew chapter 1, there's a baby that's born. This baby is born in a little city called Bethlehem, a little village called Bethlehem. It's known as the City of David. And in that little city, we actually come to the place where we recognize that this baby has a story, like a family story. You have them too, by the way. Like people ask you, like, where you're from, you have to tell them the family story. Some of those stories you'd rather leave in a box up in the attic. You know what I'm talking about? But as this family story is being told, all of a sudden you flip through the story and you're like, and he's from David. Oh, from David and the wife of Uriah the Hittite. Oh, that's part of Jesus' family story. And I think in Jesus' story, God wants you to know that our hurting story is part of Jesus' healing story. For God so loved David, he sent Jesus. The one who could create a new heart. The one who looks down from his throne and sees people the way God created them. I love how Jesus interacts with people. He lifts them up and sees their value. And Jesus would come down and he would not use them for his disposal. He would actually sacrifice himself for them. And those of us who call ourselves his disciples are given a new heart to see people the way he sees them as well. You see, 1 John says this about Jesus. This is how God showed his love amongst us. He sent his one and only Son into the world that we might live through him. This is love, not that we loved God, but that he loved us and he sent his Son as an atoning sacrifice for our sin, covering over our sin. See, it's part of why, if I were to take down from the attic that box of stories and have some stories that I'd rather leave in the darkness or even leave on the cutting room floor, I can actually take those stories because of the one who brings healing into hurting stories. And if a producer were to come to me, Sam were to come to me and say, hey, we want to tell your story, I might give him that box and say, you probably need to tell these stories too. But not because they make me the hero, because they point to the one who really is the hero. The one who really can bring healing into hurting stories. And we can pray that prayer. Maybe you need to pray this prayer today with David. Create in me a clean heart, O God. Renew a right spirit within me. But I love the phrase, and God, restore to me the joy of my salvation.
Thanks again for checking out this podcast from Christ Church of Ornogo. We hope that this teaching is helping you discover completeness in Jesus and encourages you to help others do the same. If you're interested in learning more about Christ Church, visit us online at cco.church.